This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, day two of Senate confirmation hearings for Samuel Alito. Q&A time before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The issues, presidential powers, privacy, abortion, voting rights, and more are as big as they get. Hearings began at 9:30 this morning. Chairman Arlen Specter, Republican from Pennsylvania, hit hard on the abortion issue and the controversy over the 1985 memo written by Alito when he was trying to become Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel in the Reagan Justice Department.
Let me come now to the statement you made in 1985 that the Constitution does not provide a basis for a woman's right to an abortion. Do you agree with that statement today, Judge Alito?
Well, that was a correct statement of what I thought in 1985 from my vantage point in 1985, and that was as a line attorney in the Department of Justice in the Reagan administration. Today, if the issue were to come before me, if I am fortunate enough to be confirmed and the issue were to come before me, the first question would be the question that we've been discussing, and that's the issue of stare decisis. And if the analysis were to get beyond that point, then I would approach the question with an open mind, and I would listen to the arguments.
So you would approach it with an open mind, notwithstanding your 1985 statement?
Absolutely, Senator. That was a statement that I made at a prior period of time when I was performing a different role. And as I said yesterday, when someone becomes a judge, you really have to put aside the things that you did as a lawyer at prior points in your legal career and think about legal issues the way a judge thinks about legal issues.
And the questions keep coming. On today's show, we will dip in and out of the live proceedings with our own Supreme Court analysts. This hour, On Point, Samuel Alito before the Senate and the stakes for the nation. In a moment, we'll be joined by two legal scholars. But first, I asked Jan Crawford Greenberg, Supreme Court correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, to compare Samuel Alito's opening reception on day one to that of now Chief Justice John Roberts last fall.
Well, he got a much frostier reception. The hearing already yesterday was much more contentious than what we saw when John Roberts testified before this same committee back in September. And that's for several reasons. The atmosphere in Washington has changed with scandal and Democrats feeling emboldened to attack the president and some of his policies, which we saw yesterday. And also because this is the critical seat, the ball game. He's replacing Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and her vote holds the court on a number of hot-button social issues.
Jen, give us a sense of Judge Alito himself in the spotlight there.
Well, he came across as a very mild-mannered, quiet, almost nervous when he began his opening statement. Now, keep in mind, most of us have never heard Judge Alito speak, unlike with Judge Roberts, who had argued 39 cases before the Supreme Court. People were very familiar with him. So when he began speaking, it was the first time that the American people and even, you know, many others in Washington in the Senate had heard him, and his statement was striking in contrast to that of Judge Roberts. Again, so different in tone and feel, strikingly personal. With John Roberts, we heard a lengthy discourse on his views of the law, no personal statements at all. Yesterday, Judge Alito talked about his life and his experiences, his family's struggles, his mother trailblazing and employment and education. It was a personal statement.
Very high stakes in just a few days of hearings. Jan, when or how will the Democrats decide if they go to the wall here on the nomination of Judge Alito, if they go to the filibuster?
Right, because people are already expecting this to be a 10-8 vote along party lines out of committee with all the Democrats united against him. But the big question is, do they filibuster? Do they use their minority status to block this nominee? Yesterday and in previous days, several of the senators, including Senator Schumer, have suggested that that's up to Judge Alito, that he must answer their questions thoroughly and completely. He has to go further than John Roberts did, they believe, because of his long record on the bench and in government. So they have put the burden on Judge Alito. But there's only so much that Judge Alito can say. As the Republicans fronted yesterday and got this issue out there, there's a model code of judicial conduct, and he can't telegraph how he would rule on these cases. He can't make promises that he will take a certain position, because litigants, when they come before him, have to know that he's open-minded and fair. So it's a very fine and difficult line that Judge Alito is going to have to walk today and tomorrow when he faces these very tough questions from the Senate Democrats.
And yet the stakes are huge, and he's got a record. Is there a sense in Washington among Republicans and Democrats that the Alito nomination brings the court, maybe the country, to a turning point, Jen?
There is. We heard quite a bit about this yesterday from Democrats and Republicans, because this is a Supreme Court that's closely divided, 5-4, on critical social issues, and Justice O'Connor has held that key fifth vote on issues like abortion and religion and affirmative action and on. So Judge Alito, in replacing her, could shift the balance of the court. Both sides are aware of that. And we heard a lot yesterday, and we're going to hear this more today and tomorrow, about the proper role of the courts. Republicans were very aggressive in articulating their vision of the courts, that they should have a limited role, that 9 unelected judges should not be deciding these social policies, that takes power away from the people, that the legislature should be making those calls. We saw Democrats saying, no, courts are the last stop. Senator Durbin, for example, was articulate in saying the Supreme Court is the last refuge for rights and liberties. So we're going to hear more about that, the overall role of the courts and society in general.
Jan, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jan Crawford Greenberg covers the Supreme Court for the Chicago Tribune. She spoke with me from Washington. Joining me now in the studio is David Barron, professor at Harvard Law School. He's served as an advisor to Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee on Samuel Alito and did the same for the John Roberts confirmation hearings. From 96 to 99, he was an attorney in the Clinton Justice Department. From 95 to 96, he clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens on the Supreme Court. David Barron, thank you for being with us.
Good morning.
And with us from Washington is Edward Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a think tank established in 1976 to, quote, clarify and reinforce the bond between the Judeo-Christian moral tradition and public policy issues. From 2001 to 2004, he was principal deputy assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department. In 91 to 92, he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Edward Whalen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Edward Whalen, first to you, if I may. As a conservative, watching what's unfolding in the Senate with the nomination of Judge Alito, are you heartened? Do you see a change in the climate coming to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that Judge Alito will make an excellent addition to the Supreme Court, and I think that all Americans will be gratified when they see this decent and honorable man elevated. I'm not encouraged by the ugly tone that has already been prominent in the hearing, with Democrats ready to use indecent, dishonorable smears of this man. And I would hope we would see a standard of honesty used to highlight the differences that do exist on judicial philosophy.
Edward Whalen, in that spirit, let me ask you again. I mean, he's up for the bench. You're not. Do you see a change in the political or interpretive tenor of the court, a significant one, coming if Judge Alito is confirmed?
Well, unfortunately not. Despite all the talk about a possible dramatic change in the court, it's essential to remember basically how to count to 5. Justice Kennedy, already this last term, moved to O'Connor's left to become the swing vote. He will remain the swing vote. I think having a brilliant, committed justice like Alito will help improve the quality of the court's opinions, and I hope over time, with more replacements, we'll get an even better court. But the prospect that there'll be significant improvement right away is not a realistic one.
That from the conservative perspective. David Barron, let me put it to you. Do you see a fundamental change in the stance of the court if and when Alito steps in to the seat being vacated by Sandra Day O'Connor?
On some issues, certainly, because as your setup pointed out, Justice O'Connor, who he would be replacing, was in a significant vote in a variety of important matters, including some on abortion, affirmative action most well-known, but also increasingly the issues of executive power are going to be critical. And Justice O'Connor did not come from a presidential background. She had not been a lawyer to the president. She had been a state legislator, and she staked out a clear position in which she would be an important check on presidential power. Judge Alito, by contrast, was a lawyer for the president. In fact, that was his only job before being a judge. And even as a judge, he's made clear that he still subscribes to the broad view of presidential power that the Reagan administration articulated. So I would expect that he actually would be quite a significant addition to the court on cases concerning the powers of the president.
Edward Whalen says he's being smeared by Democrats. Do you see that, or do you see appropriate, tough questioning of someone who's going to affect American policy for a long time?
I don't quite understand the idea of a smear in this context. It's not as if they're saying anything about his personal integrity. They are raising some questions about his recusal, but I think in respectful and legitimate tones.
Senator Kennedy did go at credibility as an issue. That's integrity by another name, isn't it?
That's true, but I think in the context of the hearings, it's credibility with respect to how forthcoming is he being about his true philosophy. I think Ed's to be commended for suggesting that Alito is part of a process of trying to move the court in a very different direction. That's an honest statement of where conservatives are trying to go with their judicial appointments.
Let's dive into some of what has transpired already today in Washington. As Arlen Specter asked about Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a key case in the whole abortion debate, and hear about the husband's right to notification if a wife went for abortion.
In Casey, the joint opinion said, quote, people have ordered their thinking and lives around Roe. To eliminate the issue of reliance would be detrimental. For two decades of economic and social development, people have organized intimate relationships in reliance on the availability of abortion in the event contraception should fail. Pretty earthy language, but that's the Supreme Court's language. How would you weigh that consideration on the woman's right to choose?
Well, I think the doctrine of stare decisis is a very important doctrine. It's a fundamental part of our legal system. And it's the principle that that courts in general should follow their past precedents. And it's important for a variety of reasons. It's important because it limits the power of the judiciary. It's important because it protects reliance interests. And it's important because it reflects the view that courts should respect the judgments and the wisdom that are embodied in prior judicial decisions. It's not an inexorable command, but it is a general presumption that courts are going to follow prior precedent.
Judge Samuel Alito, this morning before the Senate Judiciary Committee, David Barron, Ed Whalen, let's look at first at the issue of abortion. Samuel Alito, very clear in the 80s in a memo that he wrote when he was going for a position in the Justice Department, that the Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion. David Barron, this morning, Arlen Specter going straight at this, right out of the gate. He says Roe v. Wade has become part of the basic presumption of our culture about relations between a man and women at the most intimate level, wanting to know, essentially, if Judge Alito has changed his mind since the mid-1980s. He seemed cagey as he responded to that. When he's been so clear on the record, can we accept that caginess?
I mean, there's no way in this context that he's going to answer otherwise than he did. And I think the relevant question then is what to make of the non-answer. I mean, the non-answer is I'm open-minded on the question and precedent is very important. But it has to be remembered when he wrote in 1985, that's not 1 year after Roe, that's not 2 years after Roe, that's more than a decade after Roe versus Wade itself had been decided. And there's very little indication in any of his work up until that time that he thought that the claims of stare decisis were particularly powerful as a reason for respecting Roe itself in 1985. In fact, in the memo that he wrote advising the Justice Department on its course of action in trying to cut back on Roe, he actually has a footnote in which he says there are very powerful arguments that have been raised against Roe versus Wade mm-hmm. as a legitimate precedent. And then he says the court's answer to that has been, quote, rule of law and, quote, precedent, almost in a kind of smirky aside.
Mm-hmm.
But today, all of a sudden, claims like rule of law and precedent sound much better to him because it's actually very helpful in responding to the kinds of questions that Senator Specter is pressing.
Ed Whalen, are you hopeful that a Justice Alito would overturn Roe v. Wade, given his record, given his history, given his prior statements?
Well, all Americans should hope that the Supreme Court will restore the issue of abortion where the Constitution places it, to the democratic processes in the states. I do want to emphasize that Alito's attackers cannot have it both ways. They cannot maintain on the one hand that the passage of time and intervening cases like Casey means that Roe, despite being wrong in the first place, is entitled to respect the stare decisis, and maintain on the other hand that it's implausible for Judge Alito, to leave open the possibility that the passage of time and intervening cases like Casey might lead him to a different conclusion than he had in 1985.
In other words, time has passed for him, too.
Well, time has passed for everyone. But that Roe is as wrong now as it was in 1973. It's distorted American politics for 33 years now. The American people are very capable of handling the abortion issue. They were doing so before Roe. And all Americans, no matter what their views on abortion policy, ought to welcome the issue of abortion being restored to the democratic processes.
I want to come back to look at powers, court powers, congressional powers, but executive powers have been very high on the list of issues coming into the hearings today. Senator Leahy, Democrat, Vermont, asked Judge Alito this morning about the limits of presidential powers.
Do you believe the president has the constitutional authority as commander-in-chief to override laws enacted by Congress and immunize people under his command from prosecutions that they violate these laws passed by Congress?
Well, if a question came up of that nature, then I think you'd be in where the president is exercising executive power in the face of a contrary expression of congressional will through a statute or even an implicit expression of congressional will. You'd be in what Justice Jackson called the twilight zone, where the president's power is at its lowest point. And I think you'd have to look at the specifics of the situation. These are the gravest sort of constitutional questions that come up, and very often they don't make their way to the judiciary, or they're not resolved by the judiciary. They're resolved by the other branches of the government.
Grave issues of executive authority, but hardly academic. They're in all the news headlines in recent weeks and months. Here, David Barron, we have Judge Alito talking about referring back to Justice Jackson on the limits of presidential power, saying it as John Roberts cited, it is at its lowest ebb when it looks contrary to congressional directives. We should help us understand, back in 2000, Judge Alito spoke to the Federalist Society in Washington, November 2000. This is widely quoted now that he's nominated to the High Court. And he said something that sounds very straightforward. It's hard for a layperson perhaps to understand why it's controversial. He said, all federal executive power is vested by the Constitution in the president. That seems almost obvious. The president is the executive. So why is that a controversial position?
I think that statement is controversial when you take the gloss on it that he adds in the speech about what's known as, they say, the unitary executive. And under this theory, because of their strong view of what is contained within executive power and the fact that it's located solely in the President of the United States, the consequence of that is that agencies of the government, which have, by Congress's choice, been given a fair amount of insulation from direct presidential control. Here you might think of the Federal Reserve. No one thinks the president can call up Alan Greenspan and say, here's what the new interest rate is
going
to be.
We're talking about the SEC, the FCC, the Federal Election Commission.
Consumer Product Safety Commission,
okay.
All of these different agencies.
Mm-hmm.
They have a certain amount of insulation from his direct control, and that's thought to be very good for the health of a democracy because you get some independent expert advice, not subject to political control.
So would the unitary executive impulse then say, no, Congress does not have a right to establish such agencies?
In its strong form, and advocates of that often take that position. Now, it's fair to say that Judge Alito himself hasn't gone directly on the record and going through each one of these agencies and saying that they no longer should be able to have any insulation from the president. But in speaking that language and in speaking in that form to a group of people committed to that position, I think it's a fair inference that he's at least sympathetic to that very broad view and one that's not actually consistent with Supreme Court precedent at the moment.
Ed Whalen, I want to get your view on that, but first let's listen in again here. Patrick Leahy asking Alito to respond to a specific example of the Department of Defense monitoring U.S. citizens in his home state of Vermont.
They went, according to the press, and spied on Quakers in Vermont. Now, I know some of these Quakers.
I mean, in the Quaker tradition, they've been protesting war throughout this country's history. Now, I worry about this culture we're getting, and I just want to make sure the courts are going to say, we'll respect your privacy. We'll respect your Fourth Amendment rights. You know, if you have somebody who's been spied on, warrantless spying, would you agree, and I think you did, but I want to make sure I'm right in this, do you agree that they should have a day in court?
Certainly. If someone has been the subject of illegal law enforcement activities, they should have a day in court, and that's what the courts are there for, to protect the rights of individuals against the government and to or anyone else who violates their rights, and they have to be absolutely independent and treat everybody equally.
Sam Alito before the Senate Judiciary Committee this morning. Edward Whalen, there's Senator Leahy of Vermont using the exclamation mark, saying the government has spied on Quakers in Vermont. Of course, the NSA domestic surveillance program has been a very hot issue when it comes to executive authority recently. Then there's the issue of the president interpreting laws out of the Congress, reserving the right to do that on the McCain torture bill. Do you see Sam Alito supporting a much stronger executive, the kind of executive that the Bush administration has quite openly worked to establish?
There is zero evidence that Alito's attackers have been able to point to that supports the notion that Judge Alito has an expansive view of presidential power. I don't dispute one word of what David said about what the unitary executive means. It relates, you know, primarily to this arcane but important issue whether whether heads of federal agencies need to be removable at will by the president or whether there can be some restrictions on removal. But that has nothing to do with broad questions over this overriding limitations on torture or NSA surveillance. The scope of executive power is completely distinct from whether what executive power exists is embedded in the president.
David Barron, on the Democratic side, they have to be making a calculation during this week on whether to go to the wall here or not, whether to pull out the filibuster. Are you hearing anything that you think would give them the justification, the political ammunition to do that so far?
Well, it's very early on, obviously.
But the hearings are only a few days.
Yeah,
two or three
but it's, we're a half hour into it. I mean, yeah. At some point, is there going to be the statement that's going to change things around? I think the reality of it is, if the Democrats want a filibuster, they need to be able to sustain the filibuster. And in order to sustain the filibuster, they need 40-some-odd senators.
41 out of their 45 or some 45.
And so you just begin thinking, well, where are you going to get them from? Now, obviously, a critical thing would be as if Chairman Specter decided to join with the Democrats and say that this was an unacceptable nominee. I have to say, from his early questioning of Judge Alito, my impression of it was that he was somewhat softer on Judge Alito than he was on Judge Roberts, and that he was actually trying to throw him some lifelines, emphasizing cases in which Judge Alito had seemingly taken what you could come up with as the pro-choice position in some of his decisions. That suggests to me that it's unlikely at this point that he's going to be sympathetic to an opposition to Judge Alito.
David Barron, professor at Harvard Law School, thanks for joining us. And Ed Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, thank you very much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.